Welcome to The Roundup, a North Queensland-based podcast with regional content for regional clinicians. I'm Alyssa Hathaway, a GP and family planning clinician and head of JCU's clinical school here in Mackay. This collaborative podcasting project between North Queensland Regional Training Hubs, JCU, and our local regional hospital and health services will bring you a different regionally relevant podcast each fortnight. Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands where we meet today, who were the original providers of healthcare in this region.
In this episode, I'm talking with Peter Burke, a consultant physician in the Cairns Hospital, who is a clinical immunologist and allergist. Welcome, Peter.
Hello, Alyssa. Thanks for having me.
We're really keen to talk about allergies today in the paediatric population. Did you want to start by talking us through the incidence of allergies?
Well, in particular, food allergy is common in young children. There have been studies in Victoria to show that up to 10% of children have some form of food allergy. And we certainly have a very busy paediatric allergy clinic here in Cairns. A lot of children have eczema as well. And eczema is a risk factor for food allergy. Up to 30% of children with eczema also have food allergy. But we also have children with food allergy and no eczema. So those links aren't always straightforward.
Okay, so when we're talking about food allergens, what are the most likely culprits?
Well, the most common in our clinic, consistent really with the epidemiological studies, an egg allergy would be the most common, followed by dairy and then peanuts and tree nuts. Less commonly, we have fish, some fruits, and so, but they're much less common.
And what is the most likely presenting symptom for these children?
Usually urticaria, more than just sort of perioral redness. If there's perioral redness only, for instance, that commonly happens with irritant foods like strawberries or citrus fruits or tomato sauce is another common one. Those aren't allergic reactions, but usually there'll be often a systemic urticaria. If there's additional symptoms such as vomiting or coughing or worst case, even stridor, then obviously we're getting more into anaphylaxis. But often children will have urticaria as their first sign. Another curiosity about food allergy is that young children can have an allergic reaction the first time they eat the food. And that's unusual in allergy if you think about your textbook understanding of being sensitized first. So insect venoms and drugs and so forth, people have to have had them before to become allergic, but food allergy is different in that a child can have a reaction on their first ever ingestion of the food.
So Peter, when we have a young patient in front of us who might have a food allergy, what are some of the things in the history that we need to be considering?
So it's really important to look for the timing of symptoms or signs. And parents are very vigilant about this and they often take photos and show us rashes and so forth, which are good. But we also like to be, you know, watching out for other subtle things like maybe just a cough that they had at the same time, or they might become coryzal. Vomiting is common and wheezing. Of course, we're starting to get into concerning anaphylaxis territory. And if they become floppy, reduced consciousness, that's obviously a big concern for blood pressure. So we're looking for any sign that we think might be indicating anaphylaxis. Remembering anaphylaxis is classified as two out of the four systems, cutaneous, cardiovascular, gastrointestinal, and respiratory. And so we look for, if there's at least two of those, then it's potentially classifiable as anaphylaxis. But of course, a child can come in with urticaria and vomiting and actually have a viral illness. The duration of symptoms is important. If it's been happening for a few days, it's not an allergy. Allergies are immediate and they don't usually last for very long, a couple of hours at most. Most food allergy in a child will come on whilst the child's eating the food or within 10 minutes afterwards. And it will resolve even without treatment over a couple of hours. But often antihistamines are given quite quickly or the ambulance is called and adrenaline may be given if it's indicated. So it's all about the rapid reaction is likely to be, as we say, immediate hypersensitivity or an allergic reaction. There are some other unusual and rarer presentations, one called FPIES, which stands for food protein-induced enterocolitis, and that is often delayed. So a child will be fine for about 2 hours after ingesting the food and then suddenly have quite marked vomiting, projectile vomiting, often described as, and they can actually become quite floppy just from intravascular depletion. Adrenaline is not recommended for that because they're already intravascularly dry, and so further contraction of the vasculature is not recommended. That's another type of food reaction. I'm not sure how to classify it because we don't really know the mechanism, but it's clinically described as a delayed vomiting after food. And it can happen to many different foods, but I think one of the more common ones would be rice. And some children can have more than one food. I've seen it to avocado, and it can be to more common allergens like egg or dairy as well. So that's just another type. But the main confounder of allergic reactions in children would be idiopathic or infection-associated urticaria. It's not one of the key points is it reproducible? So does it happen every time the child has some of this food? Or if it's intermittent and it's not happening every time, it's probably not that food allergy. So consistency is another important part of the history.
Right, so we're really thinking about the timing, as you mentioned, and our other differential diagnoses include the viral illnesses, idiopathic urticaria, and FPIES.
Yeah.
Right, so if we are a junior doctor in an emergency department or a GP in primary practice, and we have a child in front of us who might have one of these food allergies, what's the next step for us?
Well, certainly the index of suspicion is the first thing. Urticaria in children can happen for other reasons. So it's also important to think of a differential diagnosis. If the child's unwell with a viral illness, it may not be food allergy, but it's certainly worth considering that as a possibility because it's so common. The next thing we would recommend is trying to demonstrate antibodies, or IgE antibodies, to the food that's considered to be the cause. Now, we don't recommend exploratory testing, so excessive testing is not indicated. So if the child comes in and they've had egg, scrambled egg or boiled egg or egg in some form, and then they have a widespread urticaria and it's fairly immediate after ingesting the egg, then we'd recommend, if you want to do a blood test, to do a blood test for serum-specific IgE to egg only and not staple food mix, which is an old test that we don't recommend, because I've seen too many patients who've come back with a positive on a staple food test and then they've been told, don't eat those foods until you see the allergist. That's not very good for the child nor for the parents. So it's very important to do specific testing for the specific food of concern. It's also important that we don't give the wrong information to parents about anxiety about other foods that they might be allergic to. Most children have one food they're allergic to, and it's quite uncommon to have multiple food allergies. But we certainly see that in our clinic, but our clinic is a selected clinic of food allergic children. The first thing I'd emphasise is, does the history sound consistent with an immediate type food reaction? If so, look for evidence to support that in terms of just the one test, and then referring to a paediatric food allergy service would be the next thing to do.
So paediatric food services, food allergy services, PETA, they're not easy for us all to come by. If we did have a patient in front of us who had an urticarial reaction or some stridor or coughing or significant GI upset, as you mentioned, would it be appropriate to prescribe an EpiPen in that centre whilst we're waiting for the patient to be seen by a local paediatrician or a specialist food allergy?
Definitely. So I certainly speak to GPs on a regular basis when they've got a patient that they are concerned has had anaphylaxis. And we talk about the story of the case, and then I'm happy for them to use my name to prescribe the EpiPens. Because, as you say, access to paediatric food allergy services is not ideal in regional Australia, not just Queensland, but everywhere. And so we have to work practically with that. So I can only speak for myself, but I'm very happy for GPs to ring me and discuss the case, and then we arrange for EpiPens in a timely manner instead of waiting on a wait list for 12 months, which is not ideal and not safe.
Oh, Peter, that's fantastic news. So just to recap what we've talked about so far, according to the Victorian data, up to 10% of children will have some sort of food allergy. It's often dairy, egg, peanuts or tree nuts. About 30% of the young people who we might see with eczema would also have a food allergy, and usually will present with urticaria. Perioral redness is often related to irritant foods, as you say, those ones with high acid content like strawberries and mangoes is the other one I see quite often, and make sure there's no concomitant viral illness that might cloud the diagnostic picture then. So once we've spoken to the pediatric food allergy specialist and got an EpiPen prescription on authority, if that's appropriate, and done some initial testing with specific IgE antibodies, not the staple food mix, which is good to know. What's the natural history then for young people with a food allergy? We were always taught that they tend to grow out of these things, or are they more likely to develop additional allergies down the track?
Most children will grow out of their food allergy, particularly egg allergy. One of the measures or indicators of that is that if the child can tolerate baked egg, and that means properly denatured protein, so baked at 180 degrees for at least 20 minutes or so to denature all the proteins. If the child can tolerate egg in that form, and 80% of children who are allergic can, they're the ones that are likely to outgrow egg allergy, and usually by around the age of 5. And then dairy allergy also is often outgrown between sort of 3 and 5 years of age. 20% of children will grow out of peanut allergy, but I think it's less likely if children have multiple tree nut allergies for them to grow out of it. Having said that, there is a movement, I think, in the foreseeable future for oral food desensitization treatment, which is a bit controversial, and it's even in America where it's practiced more widely. Children who are under immunotherapy or desensitization treatment are more likely to have anaphylaxis than children who are avoiding the food. And any parent will know that it's difficult enough to get your child to eat what you want them to eat. But in these protocols, the child has to eat the food every day. So if they've got a real aversion to peanuts because they're allergic to it, it's going to be a real battle to get the child to do that. And the evidence shows actually that it's children under 3, even preferably under 1, who are most likely to benefit from this sort of oral food desensitization. So there's a lot of practicalities around it that haven't really been worked out, I think.
Oh, that sounds like a nightmare, trying to introduce the food they might have an aversion to. So, Peter, what about milk protein allergy in breastfed babies? That's something I'm being asked about more and more. How are we best able to diagnose that cohort? Because excluding dairy from mum's diet can be incredibly difficult too.
Well, it's primarily an empirical diagnosis, really. So if the child has loose stool or bloody stool and failure to thrive, then cow's milk protein intolerance is certainly a possibility. And excluding dairy from the diet, mum's diet as well, is a diagnostic intervention as well, because if everything improves by removing the cow's milk protein, then that's likely the cause. But of course, there's differential diagnoses for those sort of presentations as well. And I'd certainly recommend paediatrician involvement if things didn't look straightforward. I have to point out also that I'm not actually a paediatrician, I'm an adult physician. And my training, though, was to do paediatric allergy because back in the dark ages when I was training, there weren't many paediatric allergist.
You're not talking about the 90s, are you, Peter?
Could be.
All right. So just talking about breastfed babies then and allergies, our current teaching is to try and introduce most of the food groups within that first 12 months of life, isn't it? There's a very strong baby-led weaning program, though. How do we try and balance baby-led weaning with the importance of introducing those allergens early?
Well, I think the evidence is emerging. Some of it's more clear, but certainly, for instance, in one example I can think of is in the UK at one point, the advice was not to give peanut before the age of 3. And then they discovered that actually peanut allergy was increasing. And there's certainly been trials of introducing peanut early in life to show that children in those cohorts actually have less peanut allergy. So it's the evidence that shows that introducing all food groups before the age of 1 is more protective against allergy. So that's why it's recommended. I realise that there's all sorts of nuances and variables in that, but that's just our general recommendation.
Yeah, it can be certainly a fraught conversation with some mums, can't it? So we're trying to introduce the widest variety of foods to children before they're 12 months to try and reduce the number of allergies. We are having a conversation with the paediatric food allergist who might be closest to where we're living. We're prescribing EpiPens. How do we actually talk about using an EpiPen or other adrenaline auto-injectors with parents where that might be an appropriate tool?
We have EpiPen trainers in clinic and we demonstrate how they're used physically. There's also videos available. There are websites with most of the auto-injectors. They have their own websites with demonstration videos on there. Also, ASCIA, the Australian Society of Clinical Immunology and Allergy, which is the website is www.allergy.org.au, has a whole lot of resources around auto-injector use and anaphylaxis management plans, particularly for childcare centres and schools. So there's a lot of information out there. Anaphylaxis Australia is another resource that has a lot of patient-centred information. So we go through the technique, which is one side of it, and just important to note that the site for administering adrenaline intramuscular is the anterolateral thigh. That's where the evidence is for peak absorption. It shouldn't be given into smaller muscles because you won't get peak absorption. The other point I was going to make is that I tell patients or I tell parents that outside of a hospital environment, if they are concerned about the reaction the child is having, if they think this is going too rapidly or this looks more severe than we've seen before, just give the auto injector immediately. It's not going to harm the child apart from having a needle. To give adrenaline early, we'd rather not that they wait too long because it can take up to 5 minutes to work, and anaphylaxis can develop quite seriously within 5 minutes. Using it early outside of a medical facility is what we recommend to parents.
It is a pretty terrifying phenomenon to watch happen outside of a hospital facility, isn't it? When you're at the beach eating fish and chips or whatever, it's horrific. Now, we've talked about a few things today, Peter, and it's made me wonder if we can get some more GP allergy training in our community to help improve access for some people. Is that something we might be able to see in the future?
Well, we're certainly hoping so. This is an interest of mine, and during my time I trained GP allergist in Darwin and trained one here in Cairns, and I think it's a good model, particularly for regional Australia where people have to be more practical. And there's no reason, if you're interested in something, there's no reason why you can't learn, practice it and become what you practice is my motto. So I'm also a member of the National Allergy Council group looking at the model of shared care and increasing access to services in regional and remote Australia. And one of our projects there is to set up a rural and regional clinical allergy training network. And so people will be able to join and go through modules. We were thinking about making the training very modular based so that people can do what's relevant to their practice. So there'd be one on, say, paediatric food allergy, for instance, maybe another one on allergic rhinitis or eczema management. So there's a range of common conditions that people should feel comfortable managing.
Fantastic. That would be an excellent way for GPs or doctors in any setting to upskill a little bit in this ever-increasing phenomenon.
I think the problem at the moment is there hasn't historically been very good training around allergy. And as we've talked about here, it's extremely common. Up to 20% of the population has some form of allergy. So general practitioners are at the forefront of seeing patients coming in. And sometimes they're just not quite aware of what treatment options are in the modern era. So I think it's an important thing that even GPs who aren't particularly interested in being sort of subspecialists in allergy, it'd be great if people had at least some baseline knowledge that can help patients in there when they need it.
That's excellent advice, Peter, for all of us, if not in allergy, in whatever field we're interested in. I think that's fantastic. Now, Peter, I'm sure there are some other myths that we need to bust around other allergies that are often discussed in the community. What else do we need to know?
Well, I like the myth-busting because one of my interests, I suppose, more recently has been metacognition and the human thought processes, and it affects our clinical reasoning. You know, one adage I think it's always good to have is, why do I believe what I believe? And always fact-check whether you are still current or on the right page with things. But we hear a lot of urban myths. For instance, like the aeroplane myth where people were apparently somebody on an aeroplane had anaphylaxis after somebody else on an aeroplane opened a packet of peanuts. Now, that's just not going to happen. You have to ingest the peanut allergen to have anaphylaxis. It's not going to be a risk in that setting. Another link that's often made is between iodine allergy and crustacean allergy, and there's no link there either. The allergens in crustacean are proteins, not iodine, so that's another myth. Another concern is that people link all tree nuts together, and in fact, there are a few tree nuts that cross-react because they're related nuts, so cashew and pistachio allergy will go together. Often walnut and pecan allergy will go together. Sometimes almond and hazelnut will go together, but often people will only have one of those groups and not multiple. So the concern I have also is about people fearing galloping allergy, you know, because they've got allergy to one common food, it doesn't mean they're going to become allergic to all other common foods. And so excluding foods unnecessarily is not recommended. People should continue to eat whatever they've tolerated, particularly for children. That's important. I was going to mention another thing, because earlier I alluded to the fact that food allergy was quite unique in that you can have a reaction on the first ever ingestion. One of the theories about that is that people or children get sensitized through the skin early in life. So that's why eczema is thought to be a risk factor. The skin barrier is not normal. And minute amounts of food proteins getting into the skin are thought to be the sensitizing event against the food. So that's the mechanism that's purported at the moment. It's not intrauterine exposure that, you know, mums worry about whether they should have eaten peanuts in pregnancy. Well, that's not relevant. And the same with breastfeeding. Mums should eat whatever they like when they're breastfeeding. It's not going to result in the child being allergic.
Peter, I think that's an important point just to reinforce. We are not excluding other things from the child's diet when they have a food allergy and trying to reduce the anxiety with the family, particularly that introducing other foods to a child with a particular food allergy is not necessarily going to cause additional allergies to develop over time. Peter, before we finish, are there any other top tips or important points that we need to share with our medical community?
Well, one other link that's really important whenever you see a child or an adult for that matter with food allergy is to ask them about asthma. Fatal anaphylaxis most often occurs in people with poorly controlled asthma. And we all know about the poor perceivers of asthma. So we have patients who walk around with a FEV of, you know, 60 to 70% expected, and they feel normal because that's all they've ever known. Well, they're the people who, if they're allergic to foods, in particular peanuts and tree nuts, they are at risk of fatal anaphylaxis. So we always question whether people have asthma, first of all, and then how well managed is it? Because that's a sort of a time bomb if somebody's going around with poorly managed asthma and food allergy. The other thing is it's not necessarily just peanuts. I mean, if you look at fatal anaphylaxis, people have died from egg allergy, dairy allergy. It's not just peanut, which is where all the hysteria seems to be concentrated. It can be other foods. And the most common in adults, just by the way, is crustacean, but today we're focusing on the pediatric side.
Peter Burke, consultant physician, clinical immunologist and allergist in Cairns-based hospital. Thank you so much for your time today. We've talked about an enormous amount of information. And as you said, the website www.allergy.org.au is an enormously important resource for any doctors who may not be physicians but are interested in allergy and immunology. There are training opportunities available so that we can improve our scope of practice, better serve our communities wherever we might be, because pediatric food allergy is just one part of your work, is enormously common and potentially fatal, as you point out. Dr. Peter Burke, thank you again.
Thanks very much, Alyssa. It was a pleasure.
For more information about the Roundup or to share your feedback and ideas for future episodes, visit nqrth.edu.au/roundup-podcast or contact us at nqrth.mackay@jcu.edu.au. We also want to advise that the views and opinions presented in this podcast are those of the speaker only and do not represent the views and opinions of James Cook University, Northern Queensland Regional Training Hubs, or Queensland Health. The content supplied in this podcast is not intended as medical advice and is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Northern Queensland Regional Training Hubs is an initiative of the Australian Government's Integrated Rural Training Pipeline and is facilitated by James Cook University in partnership with public and private hospitals, Queensland Aboriginal and Islander Health Council, health services, Aboriginal community-controlled health organisations, and general practice clinics.